Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association, two men who have played a key role in presidential defense transitions over the past four decades and more. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Vago.
Good to be back, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our cyber coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems covers sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Arnold, I want to start with you. I want to get to the transition in a moment. But first, President-elect Joe Biden's team has decided who from the Trump administration is going to stay on until they're replaced after the inauguration. Obviously, large-scale retirements taking place. Air Force leadership went out on Thursday at Andrews Air Force Base. Who has been asked to stay on and why?
Well, Vago, the good news is the transition, as I understand it from reports, is following regular order and precedence and using Title 10, which is the statute that governs the functioning of the Department of Defense. And in the absence of the Secretary of Defense or the incapacity of the Secretary of Defense, the Deputy Secretary of Defense takes over. So I understand that David Norquist, who is currently the deputy, will become the acting Secretary of Defense under Title 10 with the support of the transition at noon on January 20th, when the current acting Secretary Miller term ends. So that is the right way to do it. He's the best person for the job. He's been there in the building. He's worked with the combatant commanders. On January 20th, if Austin is not confirmed, and it doesn't look like he will be, he'll be the only other civilian in the chain of command from President Biden to the combatant commanders. He knows everybody in the building. He understands where things are. He's really an expert on the budget. So I think it's really good news that the transition is following what we would call regular order and Title 10.
And I also want to point out that David Norquist also was a former comptroller of the Pentagon. Michael, there are also folks who are staying at each of the military services, much to the disappointment of Dr. Roper and Hondo Gertz and a number of others. They're going to be leaving. Ellen Lord as well, even though folks think that they did a great job. It's the prerogative of every administration to clear the decks and start anew. Talk to us about who's staying on from each of the services and why.
So, Vago, I think that first is it's really important that people are not held on by the next administration based upon the fact that they did a terrific job or not a terrific job. So the fact that someone wasn't asked to stay on shouldn't be seen as a mark against them. What a new administration does is really pick the key people that they need to hold on into each service. If there's not a retained political appointee, presidentially appointed, Senate confirmed, then the service chief has to fill both jobs. And that's happened a couple of times in modern history. And both of those service chiefs both regarded that time as some of the most miserable time they had in their entire service. So the people that the incoming administration has picked are all three controllers, J.R. Roth, Tom Harker, and John Whitley. All three with deep financial experiences within their departments. In that, I think Arnold and I see that this signals how seriously the incoming administration sees the opportunity to trim the exit budget and also put their mark on the budget that's being created right now. So this is a window into their thinking. All three of these individuals that were picked to stay have substantial both career and political service in government. They are the classic non-self-aggrandizing individuals who really do very well in government. And I think they're terrific choices. And it speaks really well for the potential of the Biden administration to get their arms around the department quickly on the things that matter.
About getting the arms around quickly is getting folks confirmed, and now we're dealing with the tyranny of the calendar. Arnold, last week, you expressed skepticism that the calendar would allow confirmation of any of the players by January 20th, as has been the custom. So Joe Biden could be the first president-elect who goes in without having anybody from his team confirmed in these key national security jobs, even though the incoming team has said and asked congressional leaders to move quickly. Where are we? What are we likely to accomplish? Who's likely to be confirmed? And if not by the 20th, what's a reasonable interval before whether it's Lloyd Austin or Tony Blinken or anybody else is going in the administration?
In terms of whether or not any of President Biden's priority cabinet nominations, defense, homeland, state treasury, Vago, will be confirmed on the afternoon of January 20th, for those whose hearings are on January 19th, in theory, some could be eligible for a Senate floor vote on the 20th. This would not include General Austin for DOD, as he requires both a confirmation and waiver vote in the Senate and a waiver vote in the House, which is not planned until at least January 21st at the earliest. So he won't be confirmed on the 20th. Also, the Director of National Intelligence nomination of Avril Haines will now have both an open and closed hearing, and that probably will delay her past the 20th as well. For the others to be confirmed on January 20th, there are two complications. First, it would take the agreement of all 100 senators to be able to take them up for a vote on the 20th. And a second complication, if the articles of impeachment have been sent to the Senate, it would also take the agreement of 100 senators to set those aside so the Senate could go into executive session for confirmations. Both of those are a very high hurdle. On Trump's first day, the Democrats only allowed two cabinet nominations to be confirmed by roll call votes, defense and homeland, whereas Obama had five by unanimous consent. And Vago, Senator Schumer doesn't even become majority leader on January 20th. He's got to wait until the Georgia elections are certified and the Georgia senators are sworn in. And the earliest they are predicting that is January 21st, while there are ongoing negotiations about committee ratios, budgets, and power sharing in a 50-50 Senate. So the outgoing majority has lots of leverage, and I don't see them to agreeing to any same-day confirmations unless they get some concessions. So the clock was always a problem, and I've repeatedly said for weeks we were in the two-minute drill with no timeouts. Now we are in overtime, and the clock is about to expire in terms of same-day confirmations.
And just to let people know, right, you were the staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee when – during the Clinton impeachment, how did that affect everything, right? Because even mundane things became political, didn't they?
Well, the impeachment articles are what's called a privilege resolution, and they take precedence over every other piece of business in the Senate unless there's agreement with 100 senators to basically, say, hypothetically spend a half a day on the impeachment trial in a half a day on Senate legislative business, then the trial will take precedent and they'll have to stay on that till it's resolved one way or the other. Even in the Clinton impeachment period, when they had it bifurcated, where in theory they could do half a day on legislative matters, the Senate did not handle any nominations or confirmations in that time frame. So if in fact the parliamentarian in the Senate rules that the trial, if the articles of impeachment are delivered to the Senate on the 19th when they're back, and then at noon on the 20th when they go back into session, that immediately becomes the business of the Senate. Unless there's agreement with 100 senators, they can't move off to something else. Over.
Michael, there is growing Republican opposition to Lloyd Austin's confirmation. Republican study group has come out against it. Dr. Elliot Cohen and Dr. Kathleen McGinnis both were somewhat less supportive of a waiver when they testified. And there are folks concerned about blurring the civil-military divide, especially in the wake of the attack on the Capitol last week, in part because of the number of active Reserve Guard veteran retirees who are involved in that, as well as militia elements, and then frustration that the Pentagon may have moved less quickly to deploy the Guard to the Capitol, in part because it was the president's supporters who were doing the attacking. How do all of these dynamics and these tensions, do you think, affect the support that Lloyd Austin will have to become the nation's next defense secretary?
Well, Vago, I think you've raised, you're focusing on what is really an important and not well paid attention to issue here associated with this nomination. There is deep-seated, almost constitutional, if not muscle memory in the nation about the anxieties about having senior military people without civil oversight. And that hearing, which occurred this week, brought some really profound, powerful voices to bear to this. This has nothing to do with Austin as an individual. It is really an institutional bias against it. We talked a number of weeks ago and said when the original act was written and the 10-year statute of limitations was set up for a retired general officer to become Secretary of Defense, that statute was set at a time in which the statistical probability of a lifespan of a four-star general was about 64.5 years of age, and that was their point of retirement. So there has been a long-standing concern about this. General Mattis got through it. I believe ultimately Lloyd Austin will, but I think this bodes really serious concerns for the prospect of future flag officers being appointed to Secretary of Defense. So I think it's a healthy discussion. It's really worth looking at. And I think it really matters more about secretaries of defense that follow, because I remain, as I think Arnold is, pretty confident that Lloyd Austin ultimately will be confirmed.
Arnold?
And Vago, I think another reason there's concern being expressed is people are looking at it in a broader context of civilian control and not just specifically about General Austin. The Commission on Strategy on the National Defense Strategy, the Independent Commission, said there was an imbalance between the military views and the civilian views, and the military views were predominant. It also, there's general belief that there's been an erosion of the capabilities in the civil side of OSD policy, particularly vis-a-vis the Joint Staff, which has gotten 1,000 times better after Goldwater Nichols in 1986. So there's got to be some restoration of capability at the civilian level, the career civilian level, to go back to when we had legendary figures like Bob Comer and Mike Armacost and people that were there that had tremendous expertise and carried on from administration to administration. So it's not just about a retired four-star general. It's also about the fact there's been a serious erosion of capabilities on the civilian side, while the military side has been significantly strengthened and for good reason, after Goldwater Nichols.
Let me ask, we've got a minute left and I want to put this question to the both of you. Michael, you're a retired United States Army infantry and intelligence colonel. You served in the reserves. Arnold, you're a retired Marine Corps major general serving in the reserves and Vietnam, first Gulf War and Iraq War veteran as well. What are the strategic implications for what we saw last week in terms of the storming of the Capitol, and that 150 members of Congress effectively voted on disinformation, right? I mean, there are friends of mine over this past week, including some Republican friends, who are like, look, how effective can these members be ultimately to judge over fact and fiction and questions of strategy if something that was not a simple factual matter became a sticking point, right? The certification of Joe Biden. And folks see a global implications to this. Arnold, what's your sense? I mean, is there any lasting damage on this? And Michael, want to get your sense as well on how to address this moment.
Well, Vago, I'd just say, Michael and I, at every point, when I started as a first lieutenant in the peak of the Vietnam War, I took an oath to the Constitution. Every time I was promoted, I took an oath to the Constitution. Every time Michael and I have served on an advisory board, we take that same oath to the Constitution. And I would say anybody that basically was involved in that activity, despicable activity, someone that worked in the Senate for 24 years and saw the desecration of some of the most hallowed places of our democracy, they were working against the Constitution. and they should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. That's my view.
Yeah. Michael.
Yeah. Vago, I couldn't agree more with Arnold. I mean, this was for me, and I know for Arnold and most of America, one of the most shameful periods of American history to see such awful behavior in one of our, in really what is our most sacred shrine of democracy in America. But I want to go to a different direction. Arnold and I have spent a lot of time looking at the window of vulnerability that exists for the United States in this period of the handoff of power. We were taught as young lieutenants, you attack into the seam of command, control, or activity. Anytime there's a perturbation, that's a weakness and you attack into it. And if you look at the history of presidential transitions from Eisenhower forward, almost universally, every time something bad happened in that time frame. Sometimes it was very immediate, sometimes it was as late as 200 days. But around the world, there are people who think ill of the United States, of America and its values. They're looking for an opportunity, and they see these kinds of things as opening up great opportunity space for mischief. So these things have profound consequences, not only for the United States, but also for the globe and the role in which the United States so critically does for people in many, many corners of this place.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on. And I should note, right, the Joint Chiefs of Staff put a note out reminding everybody in uniform that their oath is to the Constitution. And certainly, Michael, as you said, an important time to be very vigilant. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Have a great weekend. Look forward to having you back on next week.
Same to you, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Joining us now is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond, a week in which 25,000 Americans have died because of the coronavirus pandemic, bringing the death toll to more than 390,000 and another 1 million lost their jobs. And President Trump was impeached again for inciting his supporters to attack the Capitol, jeopardizing the lives of lawmakers and seeking to block the certification of Joe Biden as the nation's 46th president. Joining us are Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute think tank and the Stimson Center, who is a professor emeritus at American University, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his very many hats is affiliated with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure.
Great to be back.
Thank you, Vago.
It wouldn't be Friday if we didn't all have an opportunity to talk. Michael, certainly an extraordinary week on the Hill, right? I mean, we've got new players in terms of who the committee assignments are going to be when Democrats take control. That depends on, obviously, the certification of the Georgia election. Joe Biden has unveiled a $1.9 trillion plan to speed vaccinations, help American families, including with $1,200 monthly payments, including talking about covering childcare. And then, of course, you have the impeachment, which happened in record time and also in somewhat more bipartisan fashion with Republican members, 10 Republican members joining Democrats to impeach the president, now becoming the second president in history to be impeached. Talk to us about the dynamic of the stimulus, any sort of aerospace and defense implications for this.
So there are no, from what I can tell, defense and aerospace implications for the coronavirus package that Biden announced last night. It's quite a huge package. It's nearly $2 trillion in new spending. The summary alone is over 20 pages long. And it seems to be based on the HEROES package that initially the House passed probably about 8 to 10 months ago that never went anywhere in the Senate. And it's got a lot of things you would expect and things that people have been talking about, the increased stimulus checks for Americans, an extra $1,400 to combine with the $600 passed in the last package, extending unemployment insurance, money for vaccines, school reopenings, paid leave, extending the eviction moratoriums. But there are definitely some controversial things in there that Republicans will not like. Obviously, more state and local funding, which Republicans have been against, a small business relief, many of which targeted for people of color and minorities and women, which Republicans are already raising a stink, saying it's not going to be equitable the way that money is distributed. And then they also put in raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which is something Republicans have been against. So I don't see this package in its present form passing the Senate, especially because of the price tag. I think there's going to be an increased focus on the debt and the deficit. So I think that Biden's going to have a tough time with this. And I think they most likely will have to roll a lot of these either into a smaller package or into a larger reconciliation package that they're talking about doing later in the spring, which would include infrastructure, revenue increases that they're talking about, as well as possible environmental legislation as well rolled into reconciliation.
How is the impeachment drama playing out? I mean, there was this sense that Mitch McConnell had expressed sympathy for a conviction, although he seems to have backed off a little bit and also delayed the vote, right? And there are legal questions about whether or not Congress can do anything, right? I mean, whether an impeachment is even possible with a president who's no longer sitting in office, although Congress, I suppose, could pass legislation that says that, you know, so talk to us about how this affects everything, because regular order becomes something difficult, right? Republicans are somehow defending the president and saying that unity calls for no accountability, which is an interesting position to take for a party that puts accountability on everything as sort of a paramount consideration.
Right. So you're right. There are constitutional questions surrounding whether they can go forward an impeachment trial for a president who's no longer in office. I actually have a copy of the Federalist Papers on my desk right now because I was kind of flipping through to see if there is any guidance in there from the Founding Fathers on this. But right now, the Senate plans to move pretty quickly. Their plan is to start the trial on the day of inauguration at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, just hours after the president is inaugurated. So they're still trying to figure out a process where they can run along two tracks, right? They want to do the impeachment trial, but they also want to get Biden's cabinet nominees approved, and they want to work on this coronavirus relief process. And the procedures are going to be very difficult because you need to get all 100 senators to agree. Otherwise, the people can hold things up. However, you know, I think most people in the Senate, if not everybody, doesn't want to prolong this trial. Republicans are sick of dealing with Trump, and the Democrats want to get on to Biden's nominees and the relief package. But Schumer and McConnell still have not spoken about what those processes are going to be. But, you know, McConnell has telegraphed a little bit. I mean, McConnell has said that the president committed impeachable offenses. He also said that he was pleased that the House impeached. At the same time, Lindsey Graham is running around whipping votes against a conviction. And some Republicans are floating the idea of boycotting the impeachment trial. However, that would be a huge mistake because then it limits the number of people. It would actually work against them because it would just, when it comes time to voting to convict, it would just apply to the folks that are in the chamber. And also, as more and more evidence comes out of what happened in the chamber, that also could impact House senators' vote because they need to get 17 Republicans to go along with the Democrats. And that's probably going to be a wild card up until the end. And just to throw an additional wrench in all this, Marjorie Greene, a new member from Georgia, has announced that she is going to file articles of impeachment against Biden on January 21st in the House.
Right, which is not going to have any traction at the end of the day. And, you know, even Republican members are saying, right, that now that McConnell has gotten everything from the president, right? I mean, a dream slate of judges, three Supreme Court justices, tax cuts, deregulation, drilling in Alaska, that at the end of the day, McConnell can afford to throw Trump under the bus to definitively sort of break the party away from Trumpism, even though Rona McDaniel and the Republican leadership are embracing Trump as the future of the party, hence why he's got so much traction over people. Let me just ask you also a little bit about leadership changes. There are some questions whether Liz Cheney is going to remain the number three Republican in the chamber. Obviously, some members furious at her over her vote to impeach the president. At the same time, we have Senate shifting to Democratic control and are going to have Bernie Sanders become the next budget committee chairman. Pat Leahy will continue to chair appropriations, but then Dick Durbin, because of Democratic rules, will not be the defense appropriations chairman, right? So talk to us about some of these positional differences and the changes Democrats are doing and why that could actually hurt national security, or rather, I should say, hurt defense spending.
Sure. So first, starting with Liz Cheney, I think obviously Liz Cheney showed a tremendous amount of leadership and courage in the vote that she took, because she knew the backlash that she would face. And she is the one defense person in the leadership. She is serves on the House Armed Services Committee and is the only one in the leadership who serves on a defense committee. There is a move afoot to call for a special conference to remove her as the conference chair. And there was a letter circulating in support of her. However, the letter has been withdrawn because they actually, believe it or not, are having trouble getting signatures on the letter, from what I understand. However, Kevin McCarthy came out very strong, standing behind Liz Cheney and against these calls for her to be removed. So I do not believe that Liz Cheney is going to be removed from leadership. And frankly, some of the people that are calling for her removal are the ones that really need to worry, because I think some of the folks that encouraged and worked with these insurrectionists could have criminal liability, and some will be subject to censure by the House. When it comes to changes in leadership in the Senate, yeah, look, Sanders is going to be the chairman of the Budget Committee. And you know, I think McKenzie could probably talk a little more about this since she worked in the Senate. But that doesn't really worry me so much, because I can't remember the last time the House and the Senate actually passed the budget resolution. So I don't see the Senate Budget Committee really controlling how much money is spent on defense. I think that the guide on this is really going to come from the Biden administration and what their budget request says, and then what the 302B allocations are from the leaders of the Appropriations Committee, being, you know, Leahy in the Senate and Rosa DeLauro in the House. And then, you know, the chair of Defense Appropriations, you're right. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've seen this. I mean, if you look at the list of people who are on that subcommittee, it's likely that the sixth highest ranking member of that committee, or the eighth highest ranking member of the committee, will actually end up being the chair, either John Tester from Montana or Brian Schatz from Hawaii. I think if it is Tester, that's probably a pretty good thing for defense. Montana is a very conservative state, even though he is a Democrat representing that state. It's a pro-defense state. And I think that he would be good for the community to be able to work with.
And I should say, so is Hawaii, right? I mean, obviously, one of the most important military states we have, certainly in the Pacific. Mackenzie, what's your sense on how all of this is going to play out budgetarily?
Well, I agree with Michael about, you know, the budget committees are irrelevant, so to speak, because they've made themselves that way, because Congress has chosen not to pass resolutions in recent years of both parties at the top. Senator Sanders is going to keep defense cuts in the headlines throughout his tenure as chairman. He is proud of his amendment that was introduced and then, of course, voted on in both chambers to cut defense spending by 10%. He talks about how aggressively he's going to go after defense cuts as chairman and that he's, you know, excited to do it. What's interesting, and he's going to focus primarily, he said, on collusion. And here he's referring to defense contractors, fraud, and crossover funds. Again, really taking a hard look at the primes in particular. I think that's going to be his area of focus, and he will find sympathetic ears in the Republican Party on some of these, you know, quests, also the audit. But the audit's actually a great success story, even though it's not complete. There's so much good news there. I hope he actually does focus on the audit. So basically, this is going to stay in the headlines. While I don't think it's going to, you know, he will prevail, it's going to put pressure on his leadership if they do want to make some kind of budget deal, you know, for either this fiscal year or the next two, knowing that the debt ceiling vote is going to be in July. The odds are that they do want to cut some kind of deal to keep regular order. It's in everyone's best interest to do that, to avoid a shutdown, to avoid a spending freeze. Senator Sanders is going to do everything in his power to keep that number lower than it probably could have been if you weren't chairman.
Gordon? How do you see some of these dynamics, as well as impeachment, playing into this stew at the end of the day? And it's not just impeachment, right? Because members of Congress are now under investigation for, you know, whether or not they colluded with the pro-Trump mob that attacked the Congress and defaced it. And we're also seeing that the level of planning of these groups was actually, it wasn't just an unruly mob. There was a lot of unruly mobbery, but there were people who were very, very targeted, which is why there were two people with zip ties and body armor that showed up in the chamber in order to abduct and then potentially assassinate, right, if we are to understand these news stories, which means that there will be implications for the Republican caucus at the end of the day, right? I mean, so how do you see all of these dynamics playing together? And then, Dove, want to get your sense as well. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, a couple of points, Vago, on the question of the implications for those members of the Sedition Caucus in the House of Representatives and the smaller Sedition Caucus in the Senate. The real question here is going to be what is being unearthed as we go from here to next week and in the weeks to come in terms of actual links between those members and what happened in the Capitol. There's still an awful lot of embers around and smoke around. We haven't quite seen the fire yet, but there's clearly investigations going on that may produce communications that raise the threshold for the risks that some of the members of the Sedition Caucus pay in either one of the houses. But some of that is really on the basis of to come. And they're fighting this, of course, very hard, arguing let's have unity, which I find implausible, given as they were people who encouraged the disunity to begin with. But I think we're just going to have to wait and see how close the ties are that appear there. But every day, the drip, drip, drip here is showing a more coordinated effort than the apparent riot or mob, as it was called initially. People are starting to use words like insurrection, starting to use words like sedition, and there are Title 115, sections 2384 and beyond, statutory language about what that means that may implicate members of Congress who are not protected from being brought to heel in juridical sense. So we're going to have to wait and see on that, but the evidence seems to be building. I want to come back for a moment, Vago, though, to the question of Bernie Sanders. I was interested that neither McKenzie nor Michael talked about reconciliation. If it turns out that Joe Biden, as I understand it, if it turns out that Joe Biden has difficulty getting a package through the Senate, he'll not have a difficulty, I think, in the House, but difficulty in the Senate, the route that is very much talked about right now is going through a reconciliation bill, which is something that comes out in a budget resolution. Were that to happen, then it puts Sanders in a somewhat more influential position than he is, with the usual disrespect shown to the budget committee. And Sanders is aware of this. And it's not like reconciliation hasn't been used before. It's been used 20 times since 1980. It's been used by Democrats and Republicans. It's been used to pass the Affordable Care Act to cut taxes 3 times. It's been used for welfare reform by Bill Clinton. It's a process that allows the Congress to put through spending, revenue, and debt ceiling changes with a 51-vote margin, not a 60-vote margin. If it proves that a 60-vote is going to be hard for the president to achieve, I think there's every prospect that they'll try the reconciliation route, and that puts Senator Sanders somewhat on a more influential position.
Dove?
The president's team announced that their acting secretary and service secretaries turn out to all come from the comptroller world. Three of them actually worked for me. And the point, I think, was given that the outgoing administration stonewalled the Biden transition team when they needed budget information, it was critically important that the comptroller people who have all that information at their fingertips be the ones to essentially take over. All three of them that I know, and I'm sure the fourth as well, are all straight shooters, which means that as soon as the administration takes over, they will accelerate their ability to help out and get this budget mess sorted out. So this was a big deal, and that's why I think the Biden people made it public.
I just want to underscore what Dove said. I worked in two transitions, the one going into the Clinton administration and the one going into the Obama administration. And I have to say the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget were essential to those transitions, and they both were extremely cooperative, helpful transitions. So I think it's a wonderful thing that these three people from that world are in the positions they're in.
Let me go back to one thing about the so-called Sedition Caucus, because you had mentioned, I think, that how could people like that be serious about national defense? And the reason I think that it isn't a problem is because there's a bunch of cynics. They don't believe, or at least most of them, maybe Marjorie Greene does, but the vast majority of that 100-plus group, they don't believe what they're doing. They're just worried about primary challenges. And so When it'll come to national defense, it's going to matter as to whether they have defense installations in their districts and so on. So that in and of itself is not, I don't think, a problem. Reconciliation, Gordon's got it right on the nose, as I say, and Sanders is going to have something else. I mean, I'm hearing that the Democrats are going to pay more attention to the Budget Committee anyway. He's going to have Pat Leahy, who chairs Appropriations, who's no great lover of defense for the very simple reason, how many defense installations are there in Vermont? And so the real issue becomes who is going to chair that defense appropriations subcommittee. And what I've heard, and Mike can correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lot of this change that got Durbin out, for example, is a push by the younger members who said, look, this is ridiculous. Chairman shouldn't be chairman. Chairman of committees shouldn't be chairman of subcommittees, and members of the leadership shouldn't be, because that gives us nothing. And so that's why you're getting people as candidates who are seven or eight persons down the seniority list. That's not going to make things easier, say, for the authorizers, for Jack Reed and his committee. They're going to need an ally over at the Defense Appropriations. One other thing, though, and this is with respect to Sanders. And now I'm definitely showing my age. When I was a junior guy at the Congressional Budget Office, the chairman of the Budget Committee at the time was Ed Muskie. The chairman of the Defense Subcommittee of that Budget Committee was Fritz Hollings. And although Muskie, very much like Sanders today, wanted to cut the defense budget, Hollings ran circles around him, and Muskie was not able to do that. So one person that needs to be watched is who is going to be looking after defense under Sanders, and how will that person interact, not just with Sanders, but with the authorizers and appropriators?
I think that's a very good question. I'm going to jump the order of these questions a little bit, because I want to get Mackenzie's take on something, because unfortunately she's going to go, is the first who's going to part in a couple of minutes. Mackenzie, it was an extraordinary week. The Joint Chiefs reminded military members of their oath to the Constitution and not any individual. And one of the last things that Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller is doing is an acknowledgement of radicalization in the ranks and the importance of fighting them. So this is a two-part problem. Does domestic terrorism then, which Byron, by the way, on this program, when we looked at the year ahead, what would be the biggest sleeper problem, he did say it was going to be domestic terrorism. How big of a national security issue is this? That's A. And B, did Republican members gravely damage their credibility for voting to not certify the election on what was clearly fraudulent information that they knew? As Dove said, 90% of these guys knew it was fake. They voted on it to protect themselves from a primary challenge. And at the end of the day, that has people asking, if you guys can't tell fact from fiction, how can we trust you to make multi-trillion dollar decisions on the future of national security, right? So give us your sense on both of those, and then I'll open it up to everybody else. Go ahead.
Well, I thank Gordon and Dove for their points on reconciliation. I did intend to bring that up, and they are absolutely right. I fully expect the tool to be employed as many times as possible, because that's what Senator Sanders is saying. And he's basically said up to two times this year. There's a bunch of insider ways that you got to, things you got to do, but it's definitely likely. So everybody needs, the Republicans, I guess, need to prepare for that, and to the extent that they can. Right. So this radicalism, good job, Byron, on your prediction, right? It has been a sleeper issue, just like sexual assault and sexual violence. These have been major issues in the force. Both of them, and they are not getting better. And it's past time for leaders to acknowledge that there is a problem, firstly, and secondly, to take action. It's going to require, though, you know, sustained interest by Congress, which, to your second question, they have. They definitely have on this topic. It's just, you know, it's really delicate. I think previously it had been, I guess, considered a delicate issue because, you know, the instinct by politicians is just support at any cost. You know, you support service members and the hard work and commitment and the job that they volunteered for, you know, so we don't want to talk about these difficult, ugly things, but they are there. And the next team, I expect one that this will come up in the Austin confirmation hearing next week before the Senate when he goes first. And I would consider this probably to have legislation in the defense policy bill, the ND, the National Defense Authorization Act, also this year as part of it. So Congress is going to take this on and they're going to force Pentagon leadership to continue to pay attention to it. To your second question, there is no doubt that credibility has been greatly diminished across the board for a lot of national security leaders. Like when it comes to the work of the committees, however, you know, I was just counting up the HASC members, almost 60 members sit on that committee. You know, the bulk of the work is led by the staff and the big decisions, of course, and, you know, the bills are written by the leadership. So yes, I think it's an issue. You know, I think their best solution is to put their head down, close their mouth, and put their nose to the grindstone and just do work and, you know, be thoughtful and try and repair their reputations if that is possible.
Because we should note, right, the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, somebody highly respected, was one of those people, as was the Sea Power Chairman, as were others, right? And that was dismaying for folks to see from members who do have so much respect that they've built over a long period of time. Mackenzie, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Have a great weekend and hope you can join us next week.
Thank you.
Gordon, I want to kind of go through and get everybody's sense on this, because I do think that Joe Biden has a very, very full plate. Coronavirus, rebuilding American alliances, dealing with China, dealing with Russia, you know, what to do about Iran. And on top of all of this now, there is now a clear and pressing domestic terrorism issue that we've sought not to address, in part because they're too heavily armed and we didn't want to look at this as a, you know, we didn't want another Waco. And then another element and dimension of this is how the rest of the world is seeing us while this happens, right? I mean, this is the seed of global democracy, if you will, the model, the first democracy, a modern democracy. And this is sort of what we're seeing. And then we're seeing, you know, a major political party completely divorce itself from reality as we know it. Gordon, I want to get your sense. Dove, I want to get your sense. And then Michael, yours on how this kind of affects the debate going forward, especially if it gets more toxic over investigations. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, let me go for a moment before I comment on that to a linkage here that I think is going to be very important. It's virtually incontestable at this point that the people who ransacked the Capitol were doing so on behalf of white supremacy. The domestic terrorist threat that you're talking about is integrally linked to the issue of race in the United States. And that is one of the pieces of linkage into the military. That is to say, to the extent that white supremacy has gained a foothold in the serving people in the United States military, that is a real danger, and it's a direct link between this domestic terrorism and the military. And it comes, the threat is white supremacy. And that makes it quite fascinating because, of course, 43% of the American military are people of color. That, I think, is a very big explanation for why the all of the service chiefs and the Joint Chiefs of Staff issued the statement that they did, because they're going to have a very, very big job reassuring the troops inside the military that racism is not alive and well inside the U.S. military. And the fact that they have a big job was underlined by the report released a couple of days ago, the 2017 quadrennial report by the Department of Defense on race and the experience of race in the United States military. It's called the Workplace and Equal Opportunity Survey of Active Duty Members. And it showed that 31.2% of Black service members reported suffering racial discrimination, right, harassment, or both, higher than for Asian or Hispanic troops. And that something like 90% of the people who did not bother to report an incident of racial discrimination or harassment in the services didn't do so because they thought nothing would be done or it would make their work situation unpleasant. Now, that says something very deep and very important that is you know, happening in the U.S. military, that there is an issue they haven't dealt with adequately of white supremacists and political far rightists. There is an issue of racism in the U.S. military, and they've got to deal with it quick, smart,
you know, before there's a major problem. And that, of course, brings us to General Austin and his confirmation hearings that are coming up. I'm sure this issue is going to be raised in those hearings. I wrote a piece for Responsible Statecraft yesterday, on Thursday, that was posted basically saying it's important to get Biden to get his people in place. So let's confirm General Austin, even though I have severe reservations about the waiver being granted to recently retired generals for this, you know, as secretaries of defense. And I say so because it's important to get people in place. And one of the things that General Austin's going to have to deal with if and when he is in place is this issue of racism inside the U.S. military and white supremacists in the U.S. military.
I'm just going to say that I think that, you know, since the military draws off of society, this is a societal problem. So people who are going into the military are also reflective of society writ large, just like wannabeism. You know, may have its roots in glorification of the military, but it then is out of control in the civilian world and metastasizes and evidences itself in, you know, armed militias or what have you. Which I think, you know, you've just got to be consistent and have a national approach to addressing. I think the challenge where I think Gordon, you've artfully and thoughtfully written in the past as well about Dove. Why don't you give me your sense on where we are on this, and then I want to get Michael's take as well.
Sure. Well, first of all, when you're talking about discrimination in the military, anybody who's up for promotion who happens to be a person of color can never be sure whether they'll get promoted, even if they deserve to be. So this is a fundamental morale problem. And at the end of the day, when we talk about the military, we're talking about people at war. We're talking about unit cohesion. And let's face it, lousy morale offsets any good weapons you've got. You're not going to win a war that way. Witness Vietnam and what happened there with people shooting their own officers in the back. So this is not just a personnel problem in the general sense of that Gordon just laid out, and he's absolutely right. It's whether the military can actually do its job if some 40% of those people will feel that they're really losing out, very often without even being told why they're losing out. That doesn't help win wars, and that's what the military is supposed to do. And of course, the discrimination goes all the way to the top. Just ask the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Brown, and his amazing video when he took over the job. A couple of other points I'd like to make. First, we're going to have a lot of rebuilding to do overseas. You asked about that. Witness Mr. Pompeo, who was basically frozen out of Europe. They didn't want to talk to him. I don't know that we are now the world's leading democracy. I could point to Britain that might be doing as better than we are. New Zealand just appointed a foreign minister who's a Maori. We're up there, but we're no longer number one in the way that we've been. A light unto the nations and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of rebuilding to do, and it's going to take a concerted effort. One of the things I'm hearing is that the new administration wants to essentially reverse the order of who's in charge of national security, in the sense that the default has always been DOD. They want the default to be the State Department, and that the Defense Department really should back up diplomacy. Whether they can pull that off, the first indicator will be how much money they give to state. And if they don't, then it's all talk and no action, and we're no better off than we were.
Gordon, I know you have one follow-up point, and then I want to go to Michael. Go ahead.
Real quickly, you're absolutely right, of course, that the military is a reflection of American society. The difference is the intrusion into the forces of order who have the legitimate authority of the government behind them of white supremacy. That's a real risk, whether it's police forces or the United States military. These are people who have the capacity to use force in a way that no ragtag band of capital invaders are ever going to get themselves sufficiently organized to do. And to come back to Dove's point,
I think he's absolutely right to point out that we no longer, even Freedom House says, we are no longer the world's leading democracy. We're about 18th on the Freedom House list right now in terms of democratic practice. And we are amply demonstrating that we are incapable of behaving as a democracy, witness the last 4 years. So that's a clear statement. I think more than just giving more money to state, because state might not spend that money well, there's a real need to empower state in the policy process in Washington so that they have a more frontal position. That's the only way, I think, over the long term, you're going to have the rebalancing of the American security institutions with strategy and statecraft in the lead.
I think a lot of African Americans would tell you that they thought that the military was a fairer place when they joined it, right? Colin Powell would talk about that he felt safer when he was in uniform and on a base than when he was traveling through the South, for example, as an African American.
Let me just say, I want to be clear. I wasn't saying that the budget was the only indicator or the solution. I was saying that it was an indicator, because if they want state to truly take the lead, and they do, they've got to empower it. And one of the ways you empower it, as Gordon knows as well as anyone, is by giving them the money to open new consulates, to get the best people, to upgrade their computer capability. I mean, they operate like they're still 19th century in far too many ways, and they've got to be dragged into the 21st century. They want to, but they need help.
Michael, let me, well said, Dove and Gordon. Michael, what's your sense on all of this as both a messaging problem, as a national security problem, as a credibility of lawmaker problem? And I don't want to put you on the spot, because I know that you professionally have to work with folks, but also that you are also close personal friends and have been for very, very many years, and do serve as a mentor for new members when they enter the body, right? As a lot of particularly experienced lobbyists. I mean, what's your sense on sort of where we are and where we're going?
So I think Dove, Gordon, and Mackenzie all raised good points on this. And I think, look, obviously I was, joined the cast of characters that was disappointed with how many Republicans voted to decertify the electors last Wednesday, especially after what happened prior to the vote. However, you really can't put them all in the same category. I mean, you can't put like Mike Rogers, who's the ranking member of Armed Services, and Ken Calvert, the ranking member of Defense Appropriations, in the same category as people like Mo Brooks and Matt Gaetz and Paul Gosar and Marjorie Greene and Lauren Boebert. I mean, the people who, some of which spoke at the rally on the lips before they came over and have actively encouraged and enabled these insurrectionists. I think a lot of people did so because, and I'm not justifying what they did, but a lot of them did so because their constituents insisted they vote that way, and because they truly believe the lies that they're getting from the commander in chief, and they're fearful of a primary. And in many cases, they were fearful of retribution against themselves and their families, violent physical retribution, that they were being threatened, depending on how they voted, not only on the vote on the electors, but also on the vote on impeachment. So, I think there are clear leaders on the Capitol Hill, like people like Chairman Adam Smith, who want to figure out a way to get past this, to get going, get the committee working, and do the business of government. At the same time, the Democrats need to do everything they can to control their anger and their rage, which is highly justifiable. I mean, they lived it. Their lives were in danger. People came here with the intent on assassinating members of Congress, and they blame, and rightfully so,
many of the liberal Democratic members of Congress.
Exactly. And they rightfully blame a lot of their Republican cohorts and colleagues for inciting and enabling and encouraging this. So, and then after this happened, Democrats look at the Republicans and said, okay, we think the president should resign. Okay, he's not going to resign. Then Pence should invoke the 25th Amendment. Okay, well, we're not going to do that. Then we're going to impeach. But they were the ones that were taking action. And the Republicans were really slow to get off the block to take action. In fact, we talked last week, they made the error, I think, in saying that Antifa was, partially blamed with what happened. But as days passed, we did see an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from Steve Scalise, who's the minority whip. We did see McCarthy give an impassioned speech accepting responsibility and blaming the president for what happened the day of the impeachment. But, you know, there are Democrats out there that I fear are going to overstep. They've already sent out a dear colleague saying that the Democrats can't co-sponsor legislation with Republicans who did vote against seating the electors. There are threats to downtown. We've already seen a lot of the major political action committees in town say they're not going to give money. Many are taking a pause in the first quarter. Many are not giving to Republicans and Democrats, which is upsetting Democrats because they rightfully are saying, what did we do wrong here? Why are you cutting off funding right to us? But at the same time, there's threats against the companies that do give to those Republicans past the first quarter. And I have cautioned Democratic friends on the Hill that there's legal jeopardy involved with that. And also what they'd be doing is antithetical to where Biden is headed. Biden is the perfect president for the time that we're in. He's a good man. He's a decent man. He's a caring man. He's trying to heal the country. And the Democrats in Congress need to make sure they're not doing anything that's going to be antithetical to what Biden's trying to accomplish.
Well, I mean, right when we saw, you know, Joe Biden was very muted and careful about this because at the end of the day, he doesn't want Donald Trump from the beyond torpedoing the start of his administration in terms of setting the tone. Although I have to say, I somewhat disagree. At the end of the day, if you contribute to the breaking of it, you are culpable and still responsible, and you don't get a, okay, well, you know, now for kumbaya, right? I mean, these are the same people who were like, throw the book, you know, put Black Lives Matter protesters in jail and throw away the key because they destroyed, you know, stores. That was awful and shouldn't have happened. But at the end of the day, it was a culmination of 400 years of racism accentuated by the, you know, live snuffing out of the life of a human being, right, at the hands of police brutality in the latest episode of it, right? So you, like, one is a somewhat more of a legitimate, one is a legitimate frustration, whereas the other one is based on a complete contrivance. I want to
except
get to
that is in the, but let me interrupt one second. That's really in the eye of the beholder here, right? So the Republicans are using
that's true. 50% of Republicans believe that it's Biden's fault that demonstrators sacked, right? I mean, so the Republican communication machine is very, very impressive.
Right. But they're also looking at the protests that happened this summer. Again, I'm not necessarily equating the two, but the Republicans are equating the two, that, you know, Trump did have to go into his bunker. The White House was potentially under siege. And that, you know, look, you know, I love to quote The Godfather, right? I mean, this is the business we've chosen. So we have to, there is a government to run at the end of the day. And I think we are going to rely on leaders of both parties to figure out what the path forward is and recognize that, you know, you back the Republicans into a corner when you say things like, for example, Ron Wyden came out recently saying the only way to prevent a repeat of the Capitol riot is endorsement of a full slate of the Democratic agenda. Well, I mean, that doesn't work. You know, I mean, Republicans look at that and say unity looks like sign on to our agenda or be lumped in with all the Capitol rioters. Okay. And if you supported Trump in any way, you're at least partially culpable. And that is how they're looking at it. And it makes their stiffens their back and gets their back up even more and does not help our democracy.
The only thing I will point out is President Trump ended up in a bunker, not because anybody was charging the White House, right? I mean, that was not what was happening. It was a largely peaceful protest out it was a peaceful protest, and there were plenty of police presence, right? I mean, that was the big difference between these two, as we discussed last week. Here, the question I'm interested in very briefly from each of you is this. A lot of the sympathies, right, if you listen, and as somebody who's been paying to disinformation for a long time, the fact that we got here is totally understandable. People have descended over the decades into a hermetically sealed ecosystem that is largely full of lies that shapes everything from birtherism to racial injustice to socialism, which I think is a euphemism generally for anti-Semitism, which I think is a harder Rubicon for some, you know, but like people who will be racist will be somewhat more careful with anti-Semitism, but I think that that's an image that exists there. And they're heavily armed. They're very radicalized. They have more in common with Al-Qaeda. I hate to say this, and Islamic extremists, right? Because they have the same vision of, we are the vanguard for our people. We are a vanguard for our religion. And so there is an other element to this that fuels the fervor, and it is equally wrought and riven with conspiracy theories. You know, we were not successful in countering that ideology fundamentally, and we were at war for 20 years, and there was a lot of killing as a consequence of it. And here there is a multi-billion dollar ecosystem, media ecosystem, that exists to fuel this. I want to kind of go up and down the line. How do we do this? Because we're glimpsing at a problem that is far more serious that we have not addressed, and it is now big enough that tens of thousands of troops have to be deployed to the nation's capital and to state capitals across the country to defend against what we expect will be repeated onslaughts. And the president of the United States, I would like to point out for the audience, is still president until January 20, and every single person arrested could well be pardoned. So, which then is going to be a further exacerbating characteristic of this. How do we address this over the long term? Dove, do you want to take a shot at this, Gordon, and then Michael? But very briefly.
Yeah. First of all, this isn't an ideology. This is a faith. It's very, very different.
Which makes it more dangerous.
Which makes it much more dangerous and makes it much more difficult to combat. You can't tell people to stop believing in miracles if they believe in miracles. The only thing you can do is to pick off those who are not fully committed to the faith. There are, you know, every religion has its extremists, and then it has its moderates, and then it has those who are nominally to it part of that religion. That's how we've got to deal with this. Part of the problem, and I saw this with respect to how we've dealt with the Middle East, is our leaders tend to come from much more secularized backgrounds and don't understand how to deal with religion and religious extremists and religious moderates other than paying lip service to them. We've got to peel those people off. There are going to be some who will never give up the true faith, and they will die in Jonestown. And those are the kinds of people that we're not going to get to. But there are an awful lot of others, the supporters, the backers, the funders, that we might be able to get to. It's going to take a lot of work. And frankly, it's going to take people from both parties.
Ultimately, it's going to take people from both parties. But let me just say that I think right now the primary responsibility here is with the Republican Party, which is now very fractured and should be very fractured. Way back in my past, I was a Republican. I want my old Republican Party back. You know, I want the party you could argue with, you could fight with, but in the end, you could cut a deal with the things, move things forward. And the truth here is that one party has been taken over by an extremist white supremacist faction, very much at the local level, right? That order, just in the last 24, 48 hours, there are pieces about the party has basically been taken over by this white supremacist faction. And people are kowtowing to it right up and down the line. That is not true of the Democratic Party. Democratic Party has a progressive faction that has a moderate faction. And right now, certainly the Biden administration largely reflects the moderate part of the Democratic Party in an odd kind of way. Right at the moment, it's more disciplined. And I would argue for disciplined toughness on the part of the Democratic Party, not to kowtow to this artificial mantra of now it's time for kumbaya and unity. All these demonstrations were the same. We got to come together. They were not all the same. And the two political organizations are not the same at this moment in time. So the principal challenge, I think, is for the moderate Democrats and the Democrats who don't, as Dove says, believe the faith, drink the Kool-Aid, to make a serious effort with the support of the financial backing of the Republican Party, which is considerable, to turn the Republican Party ship around or to create some kind of a moderate organization that is and leave the residue to whatever the white supremacists have done to the Republican Party at the local level.
Michael?
I think Dove and Gordon are spot on. I think Dove is right when he says that this is a faith, not an ideology. And you know, Gordon's use of the term fracture. I've been talking about that for years. I felt the Republican Party has been headed for a fracture. And I also lament the old Republican Party where, as Gordon said, we can argue with. I find myself in a position where I'm interacting with members of Congress on a regular basis, where it's very hard to argue with Republican members because they don't want to hear anything that's counter to what their current ideology is. Whereas the Democrats, you can say anything and agree to disagree. But I think, you know, we look forward to what's happening this weekend. I'm still hopeful that these 50 armed protests that are scheduled in all our state capitals, including our nation's capital, are not as big as people are fearful that they will be. And I'll give you an example. I was talking to a member of Congress who was flying back home late Thursday, and obviously his flight had a lot of people who are here protesting and participating in insurrection. So he's listening to the conversations of these folks. Hey, did you get in the Capitol? Yeah, I got in. No, I didn't make it in. You know, but a lot of the conversation that he heard, and this is obviously a microcosm, was, well, you know, we did our best. You know, we came, we fought for democracy. Oh, well, you know, time to go back on business again. I think there were a lot of very simple-minded people that were fooled by these Jedi mind tricks that got caught up in the moment, again, not justifying their behavior. And there are obviously were a group of folks that came here committed to taking over the Capitol and committed to committing violent acts. How big a number was that when you look at the overarching number? We'll see what happens this weekend and going forward.
I should point out to the audience that you ran as a proud Republican for a congressional seat in New Jersey. You were a staffer. You also served in the Reagan administration, if I recall correctly.
As an intern. I was an intern in the Reagan administration. You, I served in the Bush administration.
It was the Bush administration, excuse me.
Yes.
That's right. And that you're also were an illustrious and are an illustrious legal mind. I should point it out that you're a jurist as well. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Have a great weekend. Looking forward to having you guys back on and certainly have fingers crossed that everything goes well. You know, what I feel awful about is Joe Biden, who is a man who doesn't ask for much, wanted to take an Amtrak. This is, I find, heartbreaking. He wanted to take the Amtrak train from Wilmington to the Capitol and then get inaugurated. And I am saddened that that simple, wonderful wish, and I'll say as a fan of trains and railroad and travel in general, it would have been such a nice thing for him to do. And he is not able to do it. He is not able to have a crowd. He, you know, I mean, they could have social distanced, folks could have gone to the mall, and he cannot do any of that. And I find that that's just awful.
Vago, one of the reasons he did that, I think, is because he always used to do that when he was a senator. I used to bump into him on the Amtrak.
I did as well.
He would just sit there like everybody else. And that's part of his character.
It is. I'm very, very saddened by that. 30 seconds for the both of you. Israel is now part of CENTCOM. The Trump administration made that decision. Dove, what does that mean? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, it was okay when it was part of UCOM, but I think it's a reflection of the deals that the Trump administration pulled off, the Abraham Accord, the Sudan, and so on. So it seems to me that for planning purposes, given that the Israelis are working so much more closely with the Arabs, certainly in the military sphere, it does make sense for Israel to be brought under CENTCOM.
And of course, Kurt Campbell has been named by President Biden to be the deputy assistant to the president on Indo-Pacific. Dove, very briefly, and then Gordon, your sense on the importance of that pick, although I don't suspect anybody has any problems, right? A lot of rejoicing here on the decision.
Well, absolutely right. A lot of rejoicing, particularly in the region. The only place where they'll be gnashing of the teeth is China, because Kurt has a very, very realistic view of China and its threat both in Southeast Asia and in East Asia. And he will be giving the president solid advice. He knows Asia about as well as anybody right now in Washington.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've known Kurt for probably 30 years. Nobody with a broader range of wisdom and knowledge and experience with respect to the region. He knows a lot about Southeast Asia, which not everybody does. He's done a lot of work on Japan, China, North Korea. And I think he brings the right combination of what I call discipline toughness. He knows he's dealing with a nation that we're going to be competing with. He knows we're dealing with a nation that we're going to have some forms of cooperation with. So I think he's going to fit the paradigm for the Biden administration perfectly.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. Appreciate it. And look forward to having you on next week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.